If you want to follow along with me, I'll be reading from Judges chapter 4. Judges chapter 4. I evidently made Dan mad at me because he gave me one of a lot of tough names in it. As a high school history teacher, that's one advantage. I have a lot of strange names over the course of the year that I have to pronounce. But fortunately, the students almost always say, "How do you pronounce whatever it is?" So I can say whatever, because they seldom say, "How do you properly pronounce?" So I usually point out to them, well, since I live in Missouri, I can say it however I want. Judges chapter 4. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after he had died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor, and the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth-hagoyim. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he had pressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lappidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now she sent and summoned Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand." Then Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." She said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in the Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Then they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him, from Harosheth-hagoyim to the river Kishon. Deborah said to Barak, "Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord routed Sisera, all his chariots, and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth-hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my master, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." And he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. He said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink. Then she covered him. He said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be, if anyone comes and inquires of you, and says, 'Is there anyone here?' that you shall say, 'No.'" But Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted, so he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man whom you are seeking." And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with a tent peg in his temple. So God subdued on that day Jabin the king of Canaan before the sons of Israel. The hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin the king of Canaan until they had destroyed Jabin the king of Canaan.
I apologize. When I get to those big words, I skip over them, and he reads them. So I guess that's the difference between history teachers and me. I'm going to say some things tonight, and I don't mean to be, you all know me, most of you know me, I don't mean to be controversial. I'm just wanting us to be aware. So I've got your attention now. So the things I say tonight, I've already been through. And I just think as Christians, caution is important. So we're going to press on with this, but bear with me. I'm ready to start now. I grew up in a much different time than today. It was simpler. There was less diversification, less global communication, of course. We just had the one phone to crank. And fewer choices in everything. But it was a more honest time, yet it was more naive during that time. And far less complicated, which brings me to the subject of the Bible. I grew up with the King James Version. I didn't know any different. You could get a regular size print, or you could get a large print, which I haven't gotten to yet. You could get one with a concordance and one without, and you could get brown or black. And once you made that decision, somewhat monumental, that was it. That was all the choices you had. It used to be, I remember, that it was just certain people and evangelists that would go back to the Greek and Hebrew and look things up in their original meanings. I went year after year feeling that whatever Bible, whatever version I carried in my hand, well, that's the one that God approved of, and let's move on. It was word for word, and verse for verse. It's exactly what God had in mind. I had no conception, whether I should or shouldn't have, that the versions that started appearing on the bookshelves, that some would be more accurate than others. I couldn't imagine that there were individuals or groups of people that had special interests and hidden agendas that would infiltrate selection groups that made up the committees that would decide what words went in and how things came out. This was hard for me to accept, that the devil, I honestly believed he left us alone. He left those people totally alone, the people that wrote these versions. I'm convinced today that he has not. I guess since I didn't grow up having to be careful or cautious with what version I had at the time, I just never gave it much thought. Not till I heard the story of when VeggieTales came on to being. And I heard the story of a grandmother sitting down with her grandchildren one night, and she used the Bible, and she was telling them a story, and one of the little ones started saying, "No, no, no, that's not the way VeggieTales tells it." And I'm sure that was the case. I loved the Living Bible. It was so open and out there. And please, don't let me. These are just thoughts that I have. And I remember when I took the King James Thompson Chain Reference Bible, and I remember setting it on the shelf that my parents gave me. And I picked up the NIV. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, it didn't have as many thous and whatever in it. And I was at the time in my life where I wanted my Bible to be like everybody else's. And so the NIV came along, and just like we all went and bought a bunch of NIVs, and we went on our way. So I carried an NIV Bible around with me for a long time, and that's the only reason I had that version, as you might as well know. Unless you put them side by side and studied each word, how would you or could you know if there were shades of difference between them? But in legal terms, it's called due diligence. It's also a matter of trust. I trusted, maybe you didn't, but I trusted that everybody that wrote all the versions had the same ideas. They were good people. They worked hard at getting it right. That everything that they wrote, they had studied, and it was as pure, if you will, as it could be. You know, when I studied commentaries for a long time, I would open up a commentary to find out kind of what someone thought, Brother Zur or others. But I'd been raised in the church, and if a commentary got too far one way or the other, you know, it was just real easy. Oh, wait a minute. I'm heading in the wrong direction here. I could shut it, and I could go on. Because it was an obvious, it was a rather blatant difference between what I knew the scripture had to say. But our versions of the Bible, I think sometimes I listen from my seat and people are reading, or I'm reading and people are listening, and I'm going, I'm having trouble following them because my version might be getting way off in one direction versus another. In order to make my point, whether it be large or whether it be small, I appreciate the reading from Scott because I wanted to take just a couple of minutes to look at the story of Deborah and Barak. This account is a good example of how the storyline can ever so slightly change depending on who's telling it. And if we look closer at the background of those writing the versions, and I'm just looking at bear with me, I'm not going to take much time because I'm only going to look at one version. I'm looking at one piece of that version. So I'm kind of picking out one thing that I just want to remind us of, and then we can make our decisions there. But this account is a good example of how a storyline, or how the appropriate account, can ever slow slightly change depending on who's telling it. We already know the pillars of what we have to work with. Philippians 2:12, and that is, work out your own salvation. 2 Timothy 2:15, show yourself rightly dividing the word of truth. Acts 17, they study daily. And then again, the Revelations 22, 7 and 18, it says, I'm coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy. And in 22:18, do not add, do not take away. So just how particular, how precise, how prudent do we need to be? We are held accountable. But let's look just for a second, just for a couple of minutes at Deborah and Barak. We have in Judges 4, we have Deborah as the only female judge in Israel. She's a prophetess, and therefore we know she has a true closeness with God, prophetess and judge. The commander of the army is Barak. We know she's married. It tells us who her husband is. We don't know, hard to speculate about children. But we do know that she's not in some temple, some government building. She's doing her business the way God, it's appropriate for her to do. She's out underneath a palm tree. People are coming to her. Because of the sin of the people, that being oppressed, we've got a commander that's got 900 chariots and an army, And God is telling through Deborah, it's time to talk to Barak. There's going to be a battle, and I'm going to help the good guys win. This is where I want to make a point. If you'll bear with me and give me some leeway here. I'm looking in Judges 4:6. And I've owned most of these versions. I think I still have most of this sitting on the shelf. But the King James, the American Standard, the New King James, the Revised Standard, and the one that I'm using right now for myself, the ESV, all read, "Hath not the Lord, the God of Israel, told you?" This makes the sentence a question, which shows that God has already spoken to Barak in some manner, whether through Deborah or whatever, and given him instructions. Deborah was simply reminding Barak of God's directions. However, the NIV leaves out "hath not," which changes it, if you will. For some, it changes it into a command. So what's the point? So what? One that gives the inference that God is commanding Barak through Deborah instead of her simply reminding him. We know the rest of the conversation because we can it leads on. It's well known that Barak says, "I'll do this, but you got to go with me." She tells him, "I will, but the battle's going to go as far as glory to a woman." Well, if you didn't read any further, you'd think Deborah was going to get the glory. Well, we know there was another woman involved, how she took care of things through our reading. This would lead some to believe, from starting through this passage, this would put Barak in a bad light or a weak condition. Deborah said she would go with Barak, not that he would go with her. Nothing is said or inferred unless you do this, that she's saying, "Give me a sword and I'll show you how it's done." This account should not be spun into an endorsement of women controlling or being over men, or that women picking up a sword and going into battle then or now, but rather a helpmeet for them. She went with him only after being asked for encouragement and support. Yet some would portray Deborah as a first Joan of Arc, a take charge kind of woman, that Barak was under her authority. Yet as I finish this line, we can't forget that in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, Barak is mentioned again. This time in the same company of David and Samuel. So, what's my point? As most of you are wondering, if I haven't lost you. Why is the NIV, which I have, which I use, which I've studied, which is close to my desk, why does the NIV leave out something that could change, two little words that could change a sentence from a question to a command and alters the scene ever so slightly, but oh so greatly? I have with me tonight documentation of a woman, a lady, that worked on the manuscript for the NIV. Part of her position was to help with it flow and to help with it bring it into more modern language. I have documentation of a man who was chairman of the Old Testament Committee. She had an important role. He had a real important role. Both are homosexuals.
you'll need to decide for yourselves as to what that means to you dealing with this particular version. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I can't, I won't, I shouldn't. But what brought me to this was that they call themselves Christian homosexuals. That's what it says in the documentation that they write. We are Christian homosexuals. So, does that put some of the writings or some of the things they say in a different light? I don't know. That's up to you. I'm not and do not profess to be an expert on the versions of the Bible. There is no perfect translation, because the one verse that we draw out that we look at in particular about versions, the version I read is different than the King James Version on that particular verse, which disappoints me. My point tonight is that we just need to be aware and work out our own salvation. The devil works, as Tim told us this morning, in deceiving ways. We are to study. If that means comparing versions, going back to the Hebrew and Greek, then we have responsibilities of doing so. We have more resources today than we've ever had, and it is a daunting responsibility to use them wisely and discern God's word. I have presented cautions for us to consider dealing with versions. We need to remember that the guide we use will indeed guide us somewhere. And as I wrap up my thoughts, I've kept names out of this. I guess I'll keep this last name out. You can ask me. I get to see an older Christian friend with my friend sitting down here from time to time. So I ask him on this subject. I said, how do you feel about versions and translations and how it all goes? And he's been through it all. And he said, with a smile, he said, study, meditate, and pray. And God will see that you get it right. And I leave you with this one last verse. Philippians 2:16, that we are to be lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life.